Another year, another Spotify Wrapped, another day of me not going on Instagram because I'm really boring.
I realize they never got your Spotify Wrapped.
You never got my Spotify Wrapped because it's fucking random every year.
Oh, because you Maya listens to like ambient electronic music to write to.
That's so not true. Well, actually, to be honest, my algorithm's now all just like jazz because I keep putting on like cozy Christmas jazz and now it thinks that that's all I like.
That's all I've been listening to is like vintage jazz.
But that's not good because now that's all you're going to get, really. But I don't know. I don't need to like, I'm scrolling through my stories and every story is like, oh my God, Charlie XCX was my number one artist. And I'm like, I'm just being really curmudgeonly, but I really just don't need to every single story scroll through and see that you all listen to the same five artists. Like that, I find that depressing.
She feels left out because she didn't like Brat.
Okay, that's not true. I think Brat is mid, but and extremely overblown. Do I like Charlie? Yes. I don't know. Yeah, part of it is like a saltiness about me feeling left out of the conversation because I find my music taste is a little random. And a little bit like, it's kind of hard to put into
different
certain artists.
You wouldn't get it.
No, I don't understand how we've gotten to a point in culture where we're all listening to five artists at the same, like, I don't know, maybe this is something I missed out on, but that's just not how I approach my listening, and that's okay. But I just like, my Spotify Wrapped, they don't even send it to me half the time. I mean, this year I had to update, and that was why it hadn't been sent to me. But in years past, like, I've never had the banner appear on my homepage, so I do feel a little bit left out. I usually have to, like, search it, and then it's always kind of like, okay.
They're like, this girl does not want to see her Spotify Wrapped.
Kind of. They're kind of like, girl, this is random, mama.
You think Spotify's, like, targeting you for having random taste?
Yeah, they're like, you're a loser.
Who the fuck is this girl?
Who the fuck is that girl? So I feel a little bullied by my Wrapped. Mm. So that's part of it. And the other part is just like, feeling compelled to post on your story is just kind of like, no, I'm just being a hater, but I'm okay with being a hater about it. Like, no one's that interesting. I don't care about your Spotify Wrapped.
You're a proud hater. If I were to...
I'm not always proud. Sometimes I feel bad for being a hater. But in this context, I'm just like... Yes, I sound like an asshole. Yes, I'm being a dick, but I don't care about your Spotify Wrapped. Oh my God, you all listened to Pink Pantherist this year. We know! Groundbreaking. Like, yes, she's famous. That's my hate. I like Pink Pantherist. It's not about the artist. It's just like...
Yeah. On that note, should I share my Spotify Wrapped?
Let's hear it, Hannah.
My top artist was Leonard Cohen. My top song was Diet Pepsi, which... Wow, I'm so 2024. My age, 74, which everyone's age was like over 60.
Oh yeah, okay, the age thing was another thing that this year that I just found so obviously not correct. Like, what does that even mean? They're judging based on like what year the music came out.
What's your age?
Well, one, I don't care, and
it tells you, it's, if you look at your Spotify Wrapped, Maya, it will just tell you your age. It's part
I'm
of the like slideshow.
That my Spotify Wrapped is... Sorry, I'm not even talking into my mic anymore. One second, I have to put my headphones in.
My ears crashing out over Spotify Wrapped.
I was like fully facing the opposite direction of my mic speaking to you. Like, I'm just too heated. I'm telling you that my Spotify Wrapped does not send me these little gadgets.
It doesn't. I didn't open up my Spotify and it said it. It was like you had to click on, oh, that's your Wrapped. And then it.
No, I don't know. I don't want to know my age because that feels like a flawed system.
Oh, you're really overthinking this. You're really trying to like over intellectualize why you don't like Spotify.
I'm not trying to over intellectualize it. I'm actually acting on my like most primal emotions right now. I'm sure everyone listening can tell.
Well, like, look, I think your feelings towards Spotify Wrapped. Sorry, I'm like yelling. I can see it. I think your feelings towards Spotify Wrapped are really similar to my feelings towards Letterboxd, where everyone's like, yeah, but it's fun and I like it. And I'm like, yeah, but it upsets me. I don't like
really?
It.
Really? Oh, and I love Letterboxd. So, I mean, no, I hate almost like every top review on Letterboxd because I'm like, this is so stupid.
Like platforms where you're just like shoving your interest in people's face, which I think is what is annoying about Spotify Wrapped is it's just like, I understand. I think being like, look at this. Like, isn't this an embodiment of who I am? Like, how can I best represent myself, like, as a consumer or something?
Well, I'm like, bravo, you listened to Geese. We all listened to Geese. I think I didn't listen to Geese. You didn't listen to Geese.
I've never heard a Geese song.
I think they're great, but there's a really like ridiculous amount of Geese hatred happening right now on the internet that I just really am not a fan of. Like people really.
I just woke up one day and people were like talking about this band. I actually think that my top artist being Leonard Cohen and my top song being Addison Rae is like perfectly synthesizes my music taste.
Yeah. The duality of Hannah.
But that's like the most contemporary I've gotten in recent years is like literally just like that Addison Rae album. And so I'm very much like a mom. Like
that's not true. You listen to contemporary music, doll. More than a lot of people.
But I'm very behind.
You're behind on certain genres. With the pop girlies, you're like right there.
Maybe. But I just mean, I feel like sometimes everyone will be talking about an artist and I'm like, where did this person come from? How did that happen? Where was I?
Yeah, I mean, Geese did come, up through the ranks pretty quickly, which is why everyone's calling them industry plants because Cameron Winter's like a Park Slope kid. But to be honest, I just think it's like envy. Yeah, it's pretty like idiosyncratic music. Like the whole world is not going to like it, but I think what they're doing is pretty like sonically interesting and cool, and it's fun to have a band be big. I feel like band culture really fell away for a while, and it's nice.
You should date one of them.
I'll date one of Geese. That would be Cradle Snatching Doll. They're quite young.
How old are they? I don't know.
Very
these people.
Baby. They're very baby. They're like very early.
I don't like when people who are younger than me become famous.
That's kind of like most people, honey, because you're 29.
I know.
Oh, you're 28.
I'm 28. And a half.
It's okay. I'm the geriatric one. I really have been struggling with the age 29. Like, I'm not enjoying it. I really don't like it.
When I remind myself you're 29, I'm like, that's so random.
It gives me, like, copious amounts of existential dread in ways that I don't need.
30's gonna be amazing. That's what everybody tells me.
I don't know. I feel my skin getting thinner,
Oh, my skin. Oh, my God. You haven't seen me in a year and a half. The skin around my eyes, thin and sagging.
And that's the first thing I'm gonna think when we reunite in a week.
Yeah,
I'm gonna say, damn,
we're gonna see each other for the first time. You're gonna be like, that bitch aged terribly.
I'm gonna be like, that bitch let herself go over there in London with all her pub crawls or whatever you guys do over there.
Well, you know what they say.
How do I segue this to WikiLeaks?
I'm sorry, so you're just putting this burden on me.
I'm Maia.
And I'm Hannah.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is about communication on the internet. Online, we may have shot the shit, but have we also shot the messenger? If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps us out. Here, Hannah, help me out.
A lot.
It's 2011. An employee at JSTOR, which is Hannah and my beloved online academic archive, sends an email to MIT flagging an unusual number of downloads occurring on their site from an MIT IP address that peaked at 200,000 sessions in a single hour. The staff at MIT placed a camera in a wiring closet in one of the school buildings and discovered that the person responsible for what was essentially an elaborate hacking of JSTOR's database was 24-year-old computer ingenue and internet activist Aaron Swartz. Swartz was widely known at this time in his community for his amazing coding abilities. He won a prize at age 12 for creating a user-generated digital encyclopedia. He later became a co-founder of Reddit and was famous for his outspoken stance on freedom of information. What Swartz was doing in the wiring closet was attempting to free thousands of academic articles from JSTOR's paywall. Hannah and I know the frustrations of that.
Oh my God. Thank God I'm living with a law student, because otherwise it's so hard to read a good academic article these days.
It's really hard. Sometimes our researcher, Sarah, will be like, Maia, can we use this journal article for the video, and I'll go look and it's $65 and it's like a 20 page article, and I'm like, why, yes, Sarah, we can. And then I promptly write it off, but it still sucks. But eventually Swartz was apprehended by MIT police and prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, meaning that his charges, which had been 2 counts of wire fraud and 11 violations of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, would have amounted to 35 years in prison.
Jesus.
Yeah, don't get me started on that shit. While he was eventually offered a plea deal, he denied it. He sent a counteroffer that also got rejected. And soon after this, Swartz was found dead in his apartment after taking his own life. His family and those in the hacking community attribute his death to the harsh treatment he received from the Massachusetts State Department. And Swartz is now widely regarded as a martyr, you know, who used his remarkable skills not to make a bunch of money like your typical Zuckerberg or Musk, but to advocate for the people's right to information and knowledge. When Swartz was only 14, he helped to develop the RSS feed, which is how we're delivering this episode to you right now. So in many ways, we owe our ability to podcast to him. He was also in communication with another infamous vigilante actor, Julian Assange, during the peak days of WikiLeaks. And when Swartz died, another vigilante group, Anonymous, conducted a widespread hacking of MIT's domain in revenge for his death. So what Swartz was doing when he hacked into JSTOR has a name. It's called, as I'm sure many of you have guessed, hacktivism. Hannah, can you take a wild guess as to what hacktivism entails?
It's when someone employs their killer hacker skills in order to achieve some kind of political objective for what they believe to be a greater good by getting into the mainframe.
Do you have like a favorite hacking moment in pop culture?
Yeah, I have to say, I'm just so grateful that Mark Zuckerberg hacked into all of those weird college website groups so that he could get pictures of girls so then we could one day have Facebook and make the world a better place. And I can't wait to live in Meta.
He did all that so we could vague book and say, really sad right now, don't ask.
Yeah, I wouldn't have been able to post, because you said forever and always on my Facebook account in the year 2010, were it not for Mark Zuckerberg's desire to rank women against each other. Thank you.
Although, and we will make this distinction, what Zuckerberg was doing was not hacktivism, just mere hacking.
More like
slacking.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is why we shouldn't cover this topic.
What do you mean?
Yes. Hannah, your initial instinct was right. There are a lot of names for different subsets of hacktivists. There's hackers, e-bandits, cypherpunks.
Ooh, I like that one.
Yes, except a subset of which would actually go on to found Bitcoin.
I feel like every cool online rebel ends up like doing something I hate.
Not these guys. Not these guys in this episode that we'll talk about. Not Aaron Swartz, for example. There's also freaks with a PH. And yeah, hacktivism is pretty broad in its application. But it boils down to people using information technologies, typically by hacking into them with, like you said, the goal of political action, political objective. So this can be just like, you know, defacing a website. Like when Aaron Swartz died, hackers redirected MIT's traffic to a hacked Harvard site that had a banner on it which said RIP Aaron Swartz. So it ranged from that to equipping citizens with military grade encryption. It's basically like how Robin Hood steals from the rich and gives to the needy, but here they're empowering the needy with information that makes the rich look weak. The point is to basically like embarrass those in power. And unlike with, you know, Watergate, when Daniel Ellsberg was literally physically smuggling government documents from his office in bulk, like having to go back over and over again to get the entire load, these guys are using their coding skills to do it with basically the click of a button and to do it anonymously too. So Stephen Levy, who's one of the earlier tech journalists, wrote a book in 1984 called Hackers, Heroes of the Computer Revolution, where he outlines what he calls a hacker ethic. What do you think their ethos is, Hannah? Their tenets.
Well, I think, like you were saying, it's like this sort of Robin Hood mentality, right? The idea of like not having things like hidden, maybe behind paywalls or maybe like hidden because it's like confidential, like correspondence. It's like the idea of freedom and like, I don't want to say freedom of information because it's like, duh, That seems like, but like, essentially.
Yeah, well, he summarizes the hacker ethic in this sentence. He says, access to computers and anything that might teach you something about the way the world works should be unlimited and total. And yeah, so it does come with some core tenets. Like you said, all information should be free. Another one is hackers should be judged by their hacking, not bogus criteria such as degrees, age, race, or position. There's another one that's, you can create art and beauty on a computer. And another is, computers can change your life for the better. It's very tech utopian.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, like, this, like, also, like, this libertarianism that just kind of flowed through that entire sort of early internet era and, like, a lot of the pioneers of what would be the internet we know today. Like, yeah, tech utopian for sure.
Yes, libertarian is exactly right. According to Levy, hackers believe that their jobs are basically to toggle with flaws in computers, flaws in the internet, and like make them better. And no one should be getting in the way of that. As he puts it, in a perfect hacker world, anyone pissed off enough to open up a control box near a traffic light and take it apart to make it work better should be perfectly welcome to make the attempt. So getting to what you said about libertarianism, there's this 60 Minutes interview with Julian Assange, who we're going to talk about more in a bit, where he said something that really piqued my interest.
Well, I first became involved with computers when I was 13 or so, and I was unusually adept. I saw a sort of intellectual opportunity, understanding how to program and understanding how these complex machines work. And that was part of a social culture in cracking codes to prove that you could do it. It's very actually normal and healthy amongst young men. You see it in skateboarders that are competing to show that they are capable in learning the best tricks.
What do you think of that?
For sure. Yeah, like this idea of like one-upsmanship. And I think that's how a lot of stuff begins, is like a couple of guys trying to like best their friends. And that's what like encourages people to kind of take things to the next level, for sure.
Yeah, healthy competition or some sort of like shared interest around skills.
Also, I think this idea of like skateboarding, there's like an association with rebellion, like a disregard for the rules. It's a bit punk.
Yes, it is a bit punk. That's exactly the nails on the head. I was also reading that Anonymous has a reputation for emboldening younger generations who would usually be apathetic towards politics to get involved by way of hacking. And I thought this was all really interesting because, like, even from the research, you get a sense of what you're saying, Hannah, this, like, youthful zeal coming from these guys. Like, there's almost, like, a sexiness or a cachet to the way that things are done because of this, like, combustion of rebellion and extreme skill and, like, technical proficiency.
Have you ever seen, like, a 90s movie with hackers? They all have, like, mohawks and, like, cyberpunk aesthetics. Like, they look sick.
Yeah, the music's always cool, and you're, like, watching these lines of code, like, rain falling type shit. Yeah. And I think a lot of that youthful cachet also comes from how these groups operate. So you already kind of picked this up, but one of the core tenets that Levy articulates is also mistrust authority, promote decentralization. What do you think he's talking about in this context? What does that mean to hackers?
I think a lot of people who did ascribe to this sort of like techno-utopian ideal, like really liked the idea of the internet offering up this opportunity for everything to be decentralized, breaking up these boundaries, making everything accessible to anybody, and like being able to just like transcend a lot of like physical limitations as well. And so like, I think the idea of, I don't know, like when I was doing the Deadheads episode, you could see this sort of vision that they had, like a government-free society, essentially. Yeah, I think, like, I can just see, in this case, this idea that there's a mistrust of the bodies in power. So, like, the internet is supposed to be this, like, alternative version of reality where, like, the people govern themselves, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it also makes me think a bit of the Chat Rooms episode with the Muds and the Moos and that creepy guy whose name neither of us can remember, who this like one chat room decided to like come together and kick out.
And they basically like through this, they invented like their own system of governing. If you haven't listened to that episode, go listen. But it sparked a lot of debates about like what the best mode of government would be to implement into this like society that I think initially was like striving to be government free.
Well, it was lawless. Like, when the internet first came about, when the Web 2.0 was in its infancy, it was lawless and exciting and had so much potential. And so you could see how starting from scratch would really help, or, like, would really feel like a possibility to, like, kind of dream up any sort of alternative situation. Yeah, basically, hacktivists don't really have a discernible political leaning. Like, they aren't true left or true right, although you could make the argument that some of the groups we'll talk about in this episode are leaning towards left. And we will see how that kind of almost apoliticism plays out. But essentially, their one clear politic, other than freedom of information, is a belief in decentralized authority. They believe that centralized authority uses arbitrary rules to consolidate power and hoard information, and that's what they're essentially working against. So within their own groups, there's no clear one leader often, with the idea being that if one person gets taken down, another will spring up in their place. And this ethos also extends to how they approach the public. They're basically, you know, directly intervening in the standard top-down flow of information by hacking and then equipping the masses with tools to secure themselves against government control, whether that be through information or encryption, advice, etc. It's like the internet's version of handing the citizens a gun, right? Very libertarian or anarchic, however you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We haven't really seen anarchy play out in a large scale in real life in a sustained way. And it does make you think that, like, in these earlier days, it felt like the internet could be the only real place where anarchy is able to flourish, like the only fruitful environment for it,
mm-hmm.
which must have been so cool for these people back in, like, whatever, the 80s and stuff.
Well, it's so interesting, like, when I was researching again for, like, a lot of the early internet episodes, it was so interesting to see their vision. Like, I'm like, especially, these are all these, like, San Francisco, I mean, in, like, the cases of the ones that I've done, but it's like these sort of people who are very libertarian at heart and, like, are just, like, having these sort of dreams of, like, what cyberspace would allow for us. And it's like, I get it. I get why they, like, were so into that and so obsessed with that, because no one could know for sure that, like, the internet was going to become such a major extension of our lives in a way where, like, there was no longer this wall up between here and there. No one saw the ways that it was just going to become a part of our daily lives. And so, like, it didn't ever get to become this, like, fantasy that they wanted. Not saying that it should have become either.
No, yeah, there's a lot of wasted potential there, and we'll get into why that is. So, quick history. Hacking culture originated back in the 50s at MIT among members of the Tech Model Railroad Club, who were basically fucking around with track circuitry. The term hack came to refer to pranks made among these guys and eventually, like, early students of AI. This rebellious spirit continues into the 70s and 80s with people engaging in what they call phone freaking, again, freaking with a PH, which is basically where you hack into telephone networks using toy whistles. Some of the guys that were engaged in this phone freaking culture would become super famous, like Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, who, as we know, are the founders of Apple, were part of these, like, early groups. Okay, some major hacktivist incidents. In 1989, NASA and US Energy Department computers were hacked by an Australian malware called a wank worm that was used to spread anti-nuclear messaging. So when employees tried to log into their computers, they would just see a message that said, "Worms against nuclear killers. Your system has been officially wanked." I find computer terminology so funny. Like, what do you mean I've been hacked by a wank worm? But again, we're seeing that kind of trolling play out with a political angle.
Yeah.
In 1994, there was a British activist group called the Zippies who shut down a bunch of government websites using a denial of service attack, which is basically this popular hacking method where you overwhelm a server with too many communication requests. And the Zippies did this in protest of government legislation that outlawed outdoor raves that played certain kinds of techno music, or it was like music that has like a repetitive beat.
Wait, what?
Yeah. Apparently in the UK, the prime minister had his like organization had outlawed. Yeah. Tried to outlaw music with repetitive beats. So, you know, fight for your right to party, as they say.
I feel like I should know this. Damn.
Because you live in London?
Yeah. I don't know anything about England. It's so funny. I truly know nothing.
You don't know about the Zippies?
I know nothing about the Zippies.
Luckily, I took a 20th century Britain class, so I can just lend you my textbooks.
Fabulous.
Honestly, it is pretty interesting. Fall of an empire, you know?
Yeah, yes.
And then one of the most famous early incidents of hacktivism was also in the 90s when a computer hacking group based in Texas called Cult of the Dead Cow joins together with basically these like Hong Kong dissidents, right? This is right around the time of the handover, to create a group called the Hong Kong Blondes, which hacked CCP computer networks to give citizens access to blocked websites. So it's kind of like targeting governments with like poor human rights records. Now we get to more present day hacktivism. Hannah, want to tell me a bit of what you know about Anonymous? Do you want to take a wild guess as to where they originated?
4chan.
Incredible. You're correct.
Wow. God, 4chan's the birth of fucking everything, isn't it?
I know. It's this season kind of made me respect it a bit more just in terms of, yeah, its origins or like what it gave rise to. But then in other ways made me hate it. But it's just interesting. Yeah. What springs up on there, I guess.
I feel like 4chan is to contemporary internet what, like, again, like these weird Dungeons and Dragons chat rooms were to early internet.
Totally. I think a lot can happen on an image board site. So yeah, the term anonymous in its internet context is native to image boarding sites like 4chan. It refers to when someone posts or requests content on the internet without signing their name to it. So it's automatically labeled anonymous by the site. So as you correctly guessed, Anonymous came up on 4chan. It's basically a decentralized group of anonymous hackers, the scope of which we have zero idea of. Like, they could be anyone. There could be thousands of them, if not more. There could be less than that.
Much like Shakespeare.
And when they do use an identifying symbol, it's usually the Guy Fawkes mask, if we're going to talk about British guys from the 1500s.
Well, yes. I just can never remember Guy Fawkes. I can never remember if they're celebrating that he was gonna blow up Parliament or if they were celebrating that he didn't.
No, he certainly kind of failed. I don't think they're celebrating that he failed to blow up Parliament, because that would be kind of strange.
Well, they're celebrating. They're like, ha, thank God this guy didn't blow up Parliament.
Is that what's going on? I mean, you're the one in London.
I know, but like on Guy Fawkes Day, my friends and I were watching fireworks, and then my other Canadian friend and I were both like, fuck, we actually don't know why we're celebrating this.
Did you ask anyone?
Yeah, maybe someone explained. I had a bit of wine to drink, okay?
Oh, no. Mom has had some wine. Don't ask her questions.
Yeah.
I know the remember thing from V for Vendetta, and then I know that he, when he went up to get hanged, he ended up just falling off of the scaffolds and died like that instead. Mm. I mean, and I know that he had his gunpowder plot, but I I'm not sure why you guys are celebrating that either. You better find out. Ingratiate yourself into your culture, Hannah. But basically, yeah, Anonymous began as more of a troll operation, like the harmless prank stuff of early hacktivism days, but eventually it took a more political turn. It's so fucking hard to narrow down everything Anonymous has gotten up to. Like, truly, I could not. That would take hours. But I don't know, a few examples. Back in 2008, they launched an attack on the Church of Scientology's websites in protest to the church censoring a video of Tom Cruise that was released by Gawker. In 2009, during the Iranian elections, they created a website that shared secret information from the Iranian government and provided activists with information on how to encrypt their communications. In 2012, they leaked a recording of a conversation between the US Federal Bureau of Investigation and Scotland Yard about basically figuring out a way to take Anonymous down. They've sided publicly with movements like Occupy Wall Street and the Arab Spring and BLM. And really, the list of their activities is endless because, again, the scope of the group could be like massive. Right. So they're very active. One of their members described their activism as ultra-coordinated motherfuckery, which I thought was pretty jokes. It feels like something in like a Fincher movie, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Like, that would have a Trent Reznor score attached to it. Guys, the holidays are just around the corner. Personally, I like to get my shopping done early. The only problem is I'm always holding out for the perfect gift, which isn't always easy to find. Luckily for me and my loved ones, Quince has me covered. With Quince, you can find luxurious gifts like cashmere sweaters or Italian wool jackets for super reasonable prices. Hannah told me she's never felt fancier than when she puts on her new Mongolian cashmere sweater from Quince, and she loves to see the shock on people's faces when she tells them it was only $50. Plus, her fingers are going to stay nice and toasty all winter long thanks to her beautiful shearling gloves. And if you thought Quince was only looking out for the fashion girlies, you thought wrong. Quince has gifting options for everyone in your life, from the home cooks to the world travelers. I, for one, have been cooking up a storm in my stainless steel sauté pan, which I bought after having a freak out about nonstick, but that's a story for another time. Find gifts so good you'll want to keep them with Quince. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash. Being moody doesn't have to be a bad thing. Sometimes it can be fun to lean into how we're feeling by surrounding ourselves with things that match that feeling. Our moods play a big role in our choice of music, food, even lighting. So why not extend that logic to cannabis products? This is possible thanks to our sponsor, Mood, an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC products right to your door. Gummies that only get you high? That's so passé. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. And with our promo code REHASH, you can get 20% off your first order at mood.com. Whether that's mind magic gummies for deep work and creativity, sleepy time to get you settled for a restful night, or chill out for some needed relaxation. THC gummies are everywhere these days, so why not go with a brand that lets you customize your experience? Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. The best part is, Mood ships directly and discreetly to your door. That means no more waiting in dispensary lines, and no risk of an awkward run-in with your mom's friend Mary. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code REHASH. So head to mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code REHASH when you check out to save 20% off your first order. And then there's WikiLeaks. So WikiLeaks is an organization founded in 2006 by an Australian hacker and international man of mystery named Julian Assange, which, like, is a great name. I feel like that really...
Yes. It feels like that's what you would write, like, someone who was an international hacker to be named.
Yes, like, it has, like, an intrigue to it. His face is also interesting. Like, he has this kind of, like, baby-esque face attached to, like, a really tall body. But, yeah, no, he wears kind of crazy outfits and has, like, not crazy outfits. He's just always wearing, like, interesting suits, and sometimes he wears, like, a red tie. He has a very, like, calm demeanor. It's all very interesting. What WikiLeaks does is encourage people from within bureaucracies, like people from the inside, to whistleblow internal wrongdoing by providing them with a, quote, high-security anonymous Dropbox fortified by cutting-edge cryptographic information technologies. Basically, it uses this online system that moves files across the web anonymously and without detection. The files are also routed through countries that have the strongest press freedom laws, and WikiLeaks keeps servers in several different countries. It also hosts files on hundreds of mirror sites, which makes it almost impossible to take down. And for a while there, WikiLeaks was really stinking shit up.
Stinking shit up.
Once again, almost impossible to summarize everything they've gotten up to. I'll try my best to give you some examples. So in 2008, there was a Pentagon report where U.S. Army intelligence concluded that WikiLeaks posed a significant security threat to U.S. military operations, and WikiLeaks just released that entire report on their own site. In 2016, they published thousands of hacked emails from Hillary Clinton's election campaign. Right. Yes, which was a huge deal.
My memory is terrible. Sorry, I just can't believe I forgot that.
Well, they're just responsible for so many things that I think once you have the information, you forget about the source. But basically, this revealed that the Democrats were basically rigging the primaries against Bernie. Ironically, this information, of course, was not included in the BBC article I got most of this WikiLeaks stuff from. But we all fucking knew that shit was rigged. In 2015, they leaked over 170,000 emails from Sony Pictures where some unsavory stuff was revealed, including the fact that Jennifer Lawrence and Amy Adams were paid less than their male co-stars in American Hustle. Ultimately ends up feeling like small peas next to the rest of this information. And then you get to the really big ones. So in 2010, they published a video taken from a U.S. military helicopter in Baghdad of men on a street. I watched it, where basically the men are milling around on the street. I'm not sure what they're up to, but someone on the transmitter says, light them all up. And the men who were suspected insurgents were shot and killed. Two of the men in the video were Reuters photographers, which made the killings a war crime that the government had covered up. Another video was released of the military murdering an inordinate amount of Afghani civilians. So again, another war crime which had been covered up. The reason that WikiLeaks came to global attention and scrutiny around this time was that along with these videos, it had released over 250,000 US diplomatic cables and over 480,000 army reports from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the identity of the person who leaked this information to WikiLeaks ended up being revealed to be Private Chelsea Manning, who was a US intelligence analyst and soldier, who has since come out as trans, and who smuggled the document files in a Lady Gaga CD case.
Wow. I did not hear that detail. Oh my God.
It's like, you can't get more American than any of this, almost. It's so fascinating. Like, we're really going high-low here.
Yeah, I was gonna say, certainly. I mean, like...
And, like, the pop culture aspect of it.
Yeah, it would be, like, a kind of a funny detail in, again, like, a heist movie to have that happen. But the fact that it actually happened, I mean, makes sense. Because when I'm looking for a Lady Gaga CD, I usually am not looking for my top secret American government documents.
You're going through airport security, they're like, wait, hold up. And then they pull out the Lady Gaga CD and they're like... I love Just Dance.
This is crazy suspicious.
That you don't have the deluxe edition. Yes. This is also when Lady Gaga was, you know, in her prime, like top of her game. So it's all making sense. Manning ended up being arrested and the case made international news. She was found guilty of 17 charges and meant to serve 35 years in prison, but Obama commuted her sentence and she was released in 2017. This situation at the time led to an avalanche of scrutiny on Assange, obviously from the US government for the leaks, you know, causing some sort of like security threat, but also because the Afghan documents, which are also known as the Afghan War Diary, revealed the names of a lot of Afghani informants who had collaborated with the US and would now be in grave danger. So his leaking of them was seen by some people to be very reckless. But again, back to the anarchic spirit, hacktivism's main politic other than decentralization is freedom of information. And it seems like in these situations, that means at all costs, right? Like Levy said, total.
Mm-hmm.
All of this made Julian Assange persona non grata. And in 2011, the NSA began an investigation on him on the grounds that he was a malicious foreign actor. This was on the heels of a 2010 rape case where it was requested that he be extradited to Sweden to face charges. Just a bit more information on this. Basically, a Swedish human rights activist named Anna Arden, along with another unnamed woman, came out and said that they had non-consensual experiences with Assange. They filed police reports that the media ended up getting a hold of, and it became a whole maelstrom where there was a whole faction saying that this was a psyop by the US to smear Assange's name and extradite him to a country where it would be easier for the US to get him. Assange corroborated this theory. Arden has maintained her position about the incident, but says that she believes in what WikiLeaks does and that Assange should not be prosecuted for his work. He ended up being granted asylum in Ecuador in 2012, but spent the entire time basically confined to the Ecuadorian embassy building in London. His asylum was then withdrawn in 2019, and he was arrested and spent 5 years in prison in England. And all the while, this whole time, the US is trying to extradite him themselves. Truly trying to get like a comprehensive timeline of this guy's criminal record was so brutal. Like every time he's like even somewhat free, some country is like, let me get him. He's everyone's enemy, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I really had to suck the teat of Wikipedia for this part. So sorry, guys.
Hey, I think that Wikipedia is a great resource, actually.
WikiLeaks, Wikipedia, you know, we wouldn't have WikiLeaks without Wikipedia.
Don't forget about WikiFeet.
Oh, for the feet pics, yeah.
Yeah.
Hannah's all up in that shit.
Yeah. And I hate to break it to you, but so are you.
Me?
WikiFeet is like where they post celebrities' feet or something.
Oh, really? And I'm all up in that?
Well, I was just making a joke, like, now that you're on the day's 100.
Oh, I meant that you're going on WikiFeet to look at the pictures.
No, I was making a joke about you being a celebrity on WikiFeet. I bet you are. Should we look that up?
No, I don't want to know if my feet are posted on the internet, thanks.
Why?
Hannah's currently looking up if I'm on WikiFeet. I'm really not important enough to be on there.
Okay, no, you're not on WikiFeet yet, but keep dreaming. Do you want me to put you on there? Oh my God. You know what's on the opening page of WikiFeet? Your AI Feet Image Studio. What the fuck does that mean?
Wait, what does that mean?
Wow, I've never been on WikiFeet before. This is so weird. Anyways, back to WikiLeaks.
Peter Ludlow wrote this article for The Nation back in 2010 that was about Assange. And basically, he credits that whole, like, logic of anarchy as being the reason he believes that WikiLeaks could never truly be taken down. He talks about how, despite the fact that Assange seems like a central authority over WikiLeaks, those mirror sites would always be there to catch it if he fell. And then he says that it's difficult to truly disable the WikiLeaks system because, quote, the group simply relied on existing electronic communications networks and the fact that there are tens of thousands of like-minded people all over the world. He was kind of wrong, though. Can you imagine why, Hannah? Like, what are some forces that you think could actually get in the way of a hacktivist organization like WikiLeaks could lead to its downfall?
I can imagine, like, one, I think with a lot of entities that aspire to decentralization, ultimately, like, what gets in the way at times is the fact that in spite of those starting principles, human ego is a powerful thing. So I can imagine that it's actually very hard to keep an anonymous or decentralized, like, operation running when you have a bunch of people who are like, wow, I just did this impressive feat.
Oh, interesting. I didn't think about this, but it is interesting because there was, like, some internal squabbling going on, like, back in, like, 2010, 2011 about Julian Assange. Like, some people within the organization were stepping down because they were, like, they thought even internally that he was acting recklessly, especially with the Afghan war documents. Like, a lot of people disagreed with his choice to release those. So I could see how even having, like, a figurehead like Assange, like, there is maybe some ego involved there. I know that for a while his, like, photo was on the banner of the site. Like, it's like a photo of him kind of, like, intimidatingly smiling. He kind of looks like a magician.
I feel like there's something kind of counterintuitive to, like, having a star figure out of your anonymous hacker organization.
That could be part of it. So that's, like, the early downfall could definitely be part of that being Assange kind of acting against the wishes of, like, the rest of his supposedly, like, somewhat anarchic group, choosing to be a leader, you know?
These groups must get a bit hubristic, where they're just like, let's just see what I can hack into.
What about some external forces? External, like, things happening outside of WikiLeaks that would take it down?
The government?
The government definitely played a part.
I mean, I can imagine, like, it's great that these hackers are really talented and are able to target these government institutions, but I can imagine that the government also have very skillful computer whizzes employed for them. Like, I mean, the internet was built by, like, the US military, basically. So,
I mean, the people who are submitting the documents are also, many of them, part of the government.
Right, right. Duh.
No, it's interesting. I mean, I'm thinking more like, what's happening outside, basically? What's happening within the public? What is the result of the government, let's say, labeling WikiLeaks like a criminal organization? You might not think that has fallout because they rely on, like, this kind of rebellious, like, anti-establishment, Robin Hood, right, like, outlaw sensibility, but that actually does have consequences, like you said. So basically, WikiLeaks, along with other hacktivist projects, are founded upon this logic that once information is in the hands of the public will then take that information and act against their governments, right?
Sure.
But what they vastly underestimate, sadly, is the power of apathy. And apathy is brought on by a few things. Like, there are many things that can contribute to it. For one, WikiLeaks releases raw data. So you're getting all this information dumped out there in the Manning case, like, over 400,000 files. What are you as a public, as, like, a layperson, going to do with all of that? Especially when a lot of it is drenched in military jargon. It's why they eventually ended up collaborating with news outlets who were able to narrativize the information. Although they did this with the Afghan video and they were accused of manipulating the material. So, like, there is a bit no winning there. But I found it interesting that, like, you almost need this combination of old and new media to really, like, get to the public, like, to shape how information is delivered to the public, which is kind of optimistic in a way, I guess, because it's like, oh, maybe we do need the news and, like, journalists. But on the other hand, like, people are even too lazy to read more than a headline these days. So it's like, how far can that even go, the narrativizing thing? it's just too much information.
But then they can, now they're, it's good, they could put their leaked documents into ChatGPT, and ChatGPT would do an effective summarization for them.
You're like, hey girl, please summarize this for me in the style of a fourth grader.
Exactly.
For another, the scholar Alastair Roberts wrote back in 2011 that the American populace at the time was every bit as cynical as Assange was. Like, this is post-Vietnam, post-Watergate, right? Like, the disillusionment had already happened around the country. People were already caught on to what the government was fucking around with overseas. Like, they knew these CIA ops were, you know, like, deposing world leaders. Like, they know this. And Roberts writes that instead, it could be said that WikiLeaks was doing the one thing Americans least wished for, increasing instability and their sense of anxiety. The more WikiLeaks disclosed last year, so that would have been like, I think 2010 or 2011, the more American public opinion hardened against it. By December, according to a CNN poll, almost 80% of Americans disapproved of WikiLeaks' release of US diplomatic and military documents. So you kind of have to also believe in the power that, like, the public knows, and they just know. Like, it's almost, like, too much. They just know. It's not really news.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, like, generally speaking, like, most people are dissatisfied with the government already. If simply just, like, taking political action and, like, organizing would actually solve those issues, that would have happened by now. We already know the government is doing terrible things, and it's like not really stopped them from continuing to do those things.
It's also forgetting that, like, government does those things domestically to its own citizens. Like, think about the Vietnam War protests and the people who were getting surveilled. Never forget Gene Seibert, you know, like,
yeah.
It's doing its own surveillance, its own version of that helicopter attack, maybe less, like, explicitly violently. But, like, even think about Kent State. Like, there was...
Yeah.
I think it's just the idea that, like, information begets action, and that's not necessarily always the case. And one of the people who was, like, high up at WikiLeaks talked at the time about how, like, they had released the stuff in 2008 and nothing happened. Like, you know, it was crickets. And then there's another force going on, which is, like, the monetary forces. So what these more utopian thinkers, like, you know, Peter Ludlow, also underestimated back then was the growing commercialization of the internet, which you were touching on earlier, Hannah. WikiLeaks relied on certain corporate entities to keep its sites going. But when it was labeled a criminal organization in, like, 2011, a lot of these companies started pulling out. And it's amazing how much power these companies actually had over WikiLeaks' supposedly kind of, like, outlaw abilities to operate. So Amazon Web Services, which is a subsidiary of Amazon.com that basically rents space for, like, the storage of digitized information, stopped hosting WikiLeaks material on the basis that it had violated its terms of service. EveryDNS.net, which was the firm that managed WikiLeaks' domain name, also suspended services so that the domain name WikiLeaks.org was no longer operable. Of course, you'd be like, okay, well, then there's the mirror sites. But then Apple removed an application from its online store that offered iPhone and iPad users access to the State Department cables, which made it harder for WikiLeaks to distribute leaked information. And then worst of all was that PayPal, MasterCard, and Visa Europe all stopped processing WikiLeaks donations. And Assange has cited that as, like, the nail in the coffin for why WikiLeaks can no longer operate today. So WikiLeaks does still have mirror sites, but what I meant by this was that it's essentially a shadow of its former self and hasn't released a document dump on that scale since Assange was imprisoned. So, which is, like, the power of money, baby.
That's the thing, is anarchy is only so effective when you're, like, living in a highly, highly, highly capitalist society. It's like, that's all great and nice. And these kind of big acts of, like, civil disobedience obviously, like, make a statement, but ultimately it's still not enough to override, like, the total power that is money and influence. And so,
yeah,
ultimately, like, the internet isn't this techno-utopia. It's not this free space. It is, like, governed heavily by, well, like, literal government, but also by, like, money.
By money. And it's also, like, you know, there is this disproportion in access on the internet, access to internet, skill access. So, like, you know, these coder guys, these are guys who are extremely proficient in coding, for example, but the masses are not. We are not at that level, right?
No.
And so you have these outlaw like tech guys doing that, but then you also have people within the government who can do that. And that's basically like, okay, the citizens having a handgun and the government having a tank, you know, like,
yeah.
So even with WikiLeaks wanting to operate anarchically and like wanting to, I mean, Assange is not an anarchist. He has said that he's a libertarian, but like even him trying to operate outside the establishment, be an outsider, it's like, well, you're still on the internet and you still have to go through these gatekept places like PayPal, MasterCard, Visa to even get money. You know, you can't accept cash through the internet. You need it to go through some sort of system that is run by people who also are technically proficient, you know. So it's a bit of like a contradictory thing, I guess, which is sad.
Well, I think it's just, again, like since the late 90s, like the internet hasn't actually, like ever since basically, I guess you could put a credit card up on the internet and you could paywall everything and like monetize everything. Like the internet has not been actually the Wild West. It's not been free. It's not really like been a place where I guess like you can embody those principles, try as you might. Unless you're in the dark web, which I don't understand.
I don't understand it either, truly. It'd be really good to do an episode about that.
Yes.
Ooh, we should do like dark web next season.
Like as a theme?
We'll figure it out.
Okay.
We'll talk about that later, honey. It does make me wonder like how people would react if the Manning leaks happened now, right? It's been over a decade. What has happened in the years since that could affect, I guess, like public opinion about that? Like what has happened in the way that we communicate with each other, like receive and absorb information, use the internet? Like how do you think that that would affect how we were to like, yeah, respond to that situation? Like, do you think we would be like, oh, gagged?
I think if I was a person in a position of power, I would definitely employ like more tactics to try and protect my correspondences and my information. I think for the like the average person who is not involved, in any major corporations or government bodies or military operations, generally speaking, like I can imagine it would make people more aware of that. But I think for like the layperson that doesn't really understand hacking, like hacking has always sort of felt like it's like a magical plot device, for example, like in films since the invention of the internet, like since the 90s, hacking has sort of been this thing you can throw into a plot to explain something because the average person doesn't understand computers enough to really know what it would entail to break into this thing or do this thing. You just need like a white guy with dreads and like, yeah, some neon lights tapping at a computer. And then we're like, sure, okay, now the plot's moving along. So I don't know, like, I don't know if it necessarily would change the average person's relationship to that stuff, because I feel like almost, and maybe this is just my own experience, but over the years I've become less afraid of like things on the internet accidentally giving me a virus or like being more shady, because I think things have become so regulated. But again, let's say like I was the CEO of a big company and I was like talking about stuff. Yeah, maybe I would take whatever measures were available to protect that.
Well, it's almost like it gags the people in power still, but it's not really gagging the masses, I guess. Yeah, I also just kind of wonder if we've acquiesced control to these big tech companies so much to really care that we're being deceived or exploited. Like, we're almost in a way more complacent than we've ever been with the most information we could ever have. Like, we are willingly using ChatGPT, we're accepting cookies, we're giving our information to 23andMe and shit with the knowledge, like the knowledge is out there that many of these companies are like, let's say, using and selling our information, harvesting our data.
Girls are tracking their periods on their phones. I'm like, don't give them that information. That's for you and the tides.
No, we're really like, bitch, go stand out on the open sea, okay? Like,
I keep trying to explain to my flatmates why I can't sleep when there's a full moon, and they all think I'm crazy for it. And I'm like, if the moon controls the tides, and I swear it like does, it controls your period in some way, and we're part water, of course I can't sleep when there's a super moon.
And also we're part water. I don't know what to tell you. Like,
we're like mostly water.
That water is fucking moving around in my body.
But anyways, I refuse to write down when I've gotten my period into my iPhone is all.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, it's so hard. Like, all these people are using these kind of like encrypted apps instead of iMessage, instead of WhatsApp, because those are compromised. And it's like, so many of us actually just don't fucking care, and we're using it anyways. And people have been yelling to us for years, like Julian Assange, like all these people being like, your information is not protected, you are at the whims of your government. And we're all kind of like, okay, but like, I want to go on Amazon. Like, I want to go buy my shit. I want to know when my period's coming. Like, it just, I wonder if it's like too far gone that none of these hacktivist groups are going to be able to like really incite anyone.
I think the average person also probably doesn't feel that their data is important enough to protect.
Yeah. And ultimately, that's not the point of protecting your data. It's not that you're interesting. It's that you need to be able to be undetected in some ways.
Instagram knows when I want to like eat a certain snack. Like, I've talked about Ferrero Rochers. I'm getting ads for Ferrero Rochers. If Instagram knows what chocolate I want, like, I don't want to think about what else they could predict about me that isn't as like easily marketable, but like, you know, would maybe be a bit more useful in the future.
Going back to anonymous, like, you know, encrypting Iranian activists' information, it's like, okay, well, what if something like what's happening with Iran's government happens to us, right? And like, I think there's just so much complacency and so much like shrugging and like, well, that will never happen to me, so I don't need to worry about that. And it's like, well, things can change on a dime, and you will be there at a time where you can't get that information back from your government and it's too late, you know? So like, it is so fucking important. Yeah, and I think it's finally maybe coming to our attention. So in a way, maybe if these leaks happened, or if these like hacktivists were coming back out, you know, like, I think last time Anonymous really made waves was during BLM, but you know, if they came back out again, maybe we are actually more aware of that now based on like recent political changes. So I don't know. Yeah, I don't want to be too cynical. Like, Roberts talks about how WikiLeaks gave way to governments becoming even more secretive and like strengthening their security networks. And basically it's like, oh, it's a consequence of hacktivism. Like, if WikiLeaks hadn't done that, then like, you know, maybe citizens would have some more a margin of access. But I don't know. I just felt like that was kind of like throwing your hands up. Does that mean WikiLeaks should just never have done it? Like, is it something that you should just like shrug and give up on because it might have a consequence? So I don't know. How do you think hacktivism could effectively reach people today if we take like a bit more of an optimistic approach?
I still think it's important to be empowered by information. Like, yeah, maybe people aren't going to do with that information what they should, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't have it. I think it's far better to like keep ourselves in the loop and to like be curious about what our government's doing, to be curious about like what people in positions of power are getting up to behind closed doors, than to just say, well, hey guys, their fucking is over. We know that. Good night.
Well, yeah, and not to be like vaguely quoting Zizek again, but he has this quote somewhere where he talks about how like with all this WikiLeaks stuff, like, now we can no longer pretend not to know. Like, it is just there, so we can't plead ignorance. We can't say that we just simply didn't know, because it's like, well, that's your due diligence. Like, you should know. It's out there, you know. I think we're in a complicated position right now. Like, I think we've seen, even through this season, this really interesting push and pull at this stage of the internet, where information is like more controlled by big tech and government more than ever, but like also kind of completely uncontrollable, like we saw with the Pepe episode, like also completely out of our hands. And I just find it, yeah, I find it this really interesting mix that we've gotten through this season of like the way that information is able to flow and explode or be contained, and the way it's communicated between us. I don't know. I was just thinking about that.
Which, thank God, we're going to be following up this very important topic with an even more important one next week. Emojis.